He was angry at me because I wasn't getting better. I remember one time he was real angry and he was raping me. And I can remember my head hitting the wall. He was really upset and angry about something. And he was really taking it out on me. I couldn't figure out what I could do because I kept feeling like every time it was over, I thought maybe this time God forgave me.
A powerful priest, sexual abuse, and the murder of a young popular nun. In the 60s and 70s, Father Joseph Maskell, a counselor at Archbishop Keough High School, is accused of molesting dozens of students, mostly women. A recent WJZ investigation revealed many of those victims confided in 26-year-old sister Kathy Sesnick just before her shocking murder nearly 50 years ago.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is your host, Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler and writer-producer on Criminal Minds. And with me via Skype from London is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And then there's me, Lisa Zambetti, casting director for Criminal Minds. I need more things after my name.
Co-host.
Real Crime Profile.
Today we're back, continuing our coverage of the Netflix docuseries, The Keepers. This has been a very disturbing and contentious docuseries. There are so many things that we have gotten very upset about and that we've been sort of venting to people about on this podcast. And believe me, episode 4 is no different. We are going to have a bunch of things to say, in particular about the prosecutor, ADA Sharon May, and her what seems like complete ignorance of the law, and certainly her complete ignorance of child sex crimes cases.
So we're on to episode 4 of the documentary, which is called The Burial. And despite many, many women coming forward to, you know, with allegations of sexual abuse by these priests, somehow it falls on deaf ears. And there's even a police officer who could also break the case wide open with what he knows, and he is too afraid to come forward, and he's just referred to as Deep Throat.
That's right. That's a lot right there. He is frightened, and therefore, or there's a fear element here, which means that he doesn't want to be identified, and he wants to stay anonymous. And of course, you know, the irony is that you ask victims to come forward and to put themselves, you know, at risk and at danger, and them coming forward to tell these, you know, these deepest, darkest secrets. But then you've got law enforcement who do not want to be identified. We don't really know the true reason why. We are speculating that it's for fear of, you know, the concentric circles of who these individuals are. But, you know, a hundred girls come forward, and there's some revelations from this individual, this police officer, right at the start, who basically said that the DA, as Jim's already mentioned her, Sharon May, was running interference with the church.
Yeah, what he said was that almost 100 women came forward and he interviewed them. And so they had to sort of like whittle it down to a manageable number. But he said that any time a priest would get named, that Sharon May would kill the case. And of course, prosecutors have prosecutorial discretion. And if a prosecutor declines a case, the police can do nothing about it unless they go federally. And I wish they had gone federally, because there has to be some interstate aspect or some federal violation here somewhere. Certainly if he's producing child pornography or sexual abuse images, he should be prosecuted federally. But in this case, and it's just this was the part of the documentary, I think, where I probably screamed the loudest and cursed the most at the TV screen, because Sharon May actually said this: "I don't have any recollection that we found pornographic materials. Maybe we did. I just don't remember. No photographs." When this police officer said, "I saw photographs in the materials that Father Maskell had buried and they unearthed of girls with their shirts open, with their breasts exposed, children. That is child pornography. That is a depiction of an abuse image, and that is illegal, and he could be prosecuted federally for that. And the fact that Sharon May could say, I don't have any real recollection that we found pornographic materials. Maybe we did. I just don't remember. I just don't remember. Give me a break. Why wasn't that like on the forefront of your mind? Why isn't that something that you would immediately pursue? And she goes, we heard that 30 to 100 women came forward. We heard? What's your fucking responsibility? Why aren't you talking to those women? Why aren't you interviewing them? Why aren't you building a case with those 30 to 100 women? That's just outrageous. Outrageous. And when she goes further to say, I don't remember the number, but the fact that we had a number of victims coming forward was enough to make us look at the situation. But prosecutors have a very specific obligation in terms of their obligation. Every case has to stand on its own merit. I can't bring in other victims to say he's guilty because he did something to these other people, allegedly. You can't do it. Well, I say bullshit, because almost every successful child pornography or child sexual victimization case is built on the back of multiple victims. In fact, every investigation that we did in the FBI, we tried to get multiple victims to come forward because that built a stronger case, and it took the pressure off any individual victim to have to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you have multiple victims against one guy for sexual victimization, that's all using the same MO, that's all using the same circumstances, that's all using the same authority and control and manipulation and grooming and coercion, all of that is evidence against that person, and you could put all of them in one case. For Christ's sake, look at the Jerry Sandusky trial. 8 different boys came forward and testified against him, and he was convicted. Of course she could have done that. Of course any child sex crimes prosecutor knows that, and that's fucking bullshit. And that pisses me off even more, because here is the justice system. She is the one that is ultimately responsible for failing these girls, for allowing these girls and many other girls for many years afterwards to be victimized because she didn't do her goddamn job.
Completely agree. The BS that comes out of her mouth. I mean, right from the start, I've got to say, I had a reaction to her when she's talking about her red convertible. What is she thinking? I mean, even if you think that they've cut her in a biased way, but it's just such an odd context to give in such a grave and serious case that she is sort of joking about her driving along in her new red convertible and ha-ha going to the cemetery. That whole context just absolutely got me reacting right from the start. And just her facial leakage when talking about these things, you know, saying, oh, no, photographs, no, absolutely not. This kind of overcompensating. I just didn't feel she was being authentic or genuine in her account. And how can she not know? She's head of sex offences, Jim. How does she not know the legislation and the law that you can use similar fact and bad character with serial predators? What is going on? What is she talking about?
It's a lie. It's an excuse. It's a way to get around the fact that she did not do her job. And she failed these children miserably. And these young women and these women who came back when they were older, she failed them miserably. And the fact is that that's, as you said, absolutely not true. And it's, at one point she says he was apparently hospitalized, and given the nature of the facility, that wasn't some place that we would have access to him. Why? What are you talking about? Just because he's in a hospital, I don't give a damn what hospital it is or what monastery or what anything. Of course they have. They do a writ of habeas corpus. They can demand that they produce the body, that his person has to be brought in front of that court, and they can go anywhere and execute that. They can go anywhere, in any place, in any hospital at any time. It's just bullshit. And if this was the Institute for Living that he was in or somewhere else, it doesn't matter. That's just a bunch of crap. And then why did the church move him around? Why did he get rid of his records? Why was he allowed to do that? Why wasn't that something that actually corroborated the fact? Did they read these records? Did they read what he had this one student type up every day for years, right? all this sexual stuff that he was doing with these victims and what they were talking about? Did they get any of that corroborating information? No. Why? Because they were wet? Because they had to dry it out? Because she didn't give a fuck about it? Give me a break.
I want to give big ups to Ryan White, the filmmaker who actually got her to sit down with him, because that could not have been easy. And thankfully she did, because you could just see her blasé manner about this case.
Her witticisms and stuff.
I'm sure if she knew how she was going to come across, she would not have sat down with him. And I don't think that there is a way that you could have cut this to make her look worse, because she just, you know, she says it all herself. So, I mean, that's another thing about this documentary that I so admire, is how they got people to talk. And that's not easy.
Yeah. And you know what else she said herself? Yeah, in the back of my mind, yeah, he did it. You ignorant fool. You call yourself a lawyer, a prosecutor? Give me a break. You work for the people of the United States or the state of Maryland? Give me a break. Yeah, he did it. But, you know, I didn't really want to go after him. But, you know, well, you know, I wanted to drive around my Mustang or my whatever, my convertible. It's just, it's such bullshit. And just, it just, again, on top, insult upon insult upon insult.
But how do you explain this? I mean, do you think that she was bought off by the church?
No,
or what? I mean,
well, it's probably a couple of things. The church has a lot of lawyers. They'd probably be a pain in her ass. But she says, but if all you have is the statement of the child, that isn't enough. Well, that's bullshit. I have prosecuted, and many other prosecutors across the United States, state, local, federal, have prosecuted based on the word of a child, period. There's been no physical evidence. Most children do not report immediately. Most cases, there's not going to be a rape kit. Most of the time, it's the details that the children put forward that actually give us a good, solid case against them. It's just outrageous that she would say that. And she says, I never felt any pressure from the church not to investigate. I didn't always get the level of cooperation that I would have liked. Again, why doesn't that corroborate the situation? What is the church protecting themselves from, if not this priest as a real and actual offender?
I mean, she also said that, you know, if there was enough evidence, then she would have charged, but, you know, there wasn't enough to go forward. I mean, someone's lying, aren't they? Full stop. It's either Deep Throat who's lying, who said that he saw that evidence, he uncovered it and spoke to those victims, and that she ran interference, or it's her. And I got to say, the way that she comes across, the things that she says, you know, the picture of her in the background in her office, her witticisms, her complete lack of regard for the victims, her lack of humility, her lack of understanding and her lack of judgment, you've got to question it. You know, this isn't someone that you would want being your advocate and fighting for you like you have, Jim, for so many victims, or, you know, someone who's going to battle tooth and nail to get the truth out there. This is someone, you know, who's complacent at best, but she certainly doesn't seem to understand the letter of the law. And I don't know what your reaction was, Lisa, just seeing her come on, you know, from the start and just that sequence.
Yeah. You know, she came across as somebody who's tough as nails and does not give a single shit about this case or this documentarian. It's like, go ahead, say what you want. I don't care. You know, just the arrogance to me was just overwhelming. And I hate to say this, is going to sound very sexist, but she's a fucking woman. I mean, as a woman, how could you turn your back on these girls?
She seemed petty. She seemed like she was more like the expressions and the little witticism she would say and the little crap that she gave. I mean, it was outrageous. And when you're talking about 30 to 100 victims.
But that's BS. Even the fact she says it's not because I didn't believe them. I mean, she certainly didn't go about trying to put this evidence together in a package that would have any chance of success.
Or ask for help. Ask for help from other prosecutors who have, in fact, used the word of a child victim against an offender, who have, in fact, accumulated multiple child sex offenses against a single offender over a period of time. I mean, it just boggles my mind how she kept her job. Unless a particular organization that basically was very prominent in that city, namely the Catholic Church and the Catholic Archdiocese of Baltimore wanted her in that position.
One thing she says is that, you know, I subpoenaed Maskell's records. He'd taken them out and they were gone. But it seems like he's left quite a paper trail behind him. It's something that Deep Throat says that I wanted your opinion on, Jim, is a pedophile cannot separate from his collection. Even if he buries it, he knows it's there. Can you talk about what that means?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, what he's doing is he's quoting me and my predecessor from the Behavioral Analysis Unit that we have done multiple. I mean, I've done thousands of affidavits for search warrants around the country for the collections of child sex offenders. They collect not only child pornography or sexual abuse images, but they also collect child erotica, things that relate to them. It could be writings, it could be drawings, it could be videos, it could be child clothing or child articles of, you know, that they play with or whatever, anything that reminds them of a child that they get a sexual erotic feeling from. And those things become their collections, and those things build over time. Now, of course, much of this stuff is done online, and they used to collect whatever they could buy, you know, from other countries or produce themselves or trade, and now they can get literally hundreds of millions of images and videos online without any problem. It's illegal, and they can get arrested for it and thrown in jail for a long time because our federal laws are very stringent about this, and you can get 20 or 30 years mandatory minimums for these kinds of crimes now. But what happens is these offenders amass these collections. They reinforce their arousal patterns by masturbating while looking at it or reading it or hearing it, and that actually makes them want to act on it even more. And that is something that they don't want to get rid of. They keep it for as long as humanly possible. They keep it as close as humanly possible. And when they get scared, what they usually do is not destroy it, but actually hide it better. That sounds like exactly what Maskell did. He had no idea that when you bury something that it's going to get, you know, trashed with the water. He probably thought he could dig it up later when the heat gets off of him. And at this point, when they do actually dig it up, it's in pretty rough shape. It's moldy. It's wet. It's probably falling apart. But I know, because I've done it myself, recovered when I was part of the evidence response team in the FBI, recovered buried written material, recovered buried photographs. And yeah, though much of it could be ruined, some of it could have been salvaged and clearly was salvaged because this Deep Throat officer who's afraid for his job, afraid for his life, afraid for his family, he said he saw that stuff. And he was very credible and he was very detailed about it. And I believe him over May because all the time she's lying. She's lied about law. She's lied about how you try cases. She's lied about the word of victims. And she's actually has the nerve to say, yeah, in the back of my mind, I knew he did it. But what the fuck?
We know that the Archdiocese of Baltimore is claiming there were no reports. On the other hand, we have been privy to a number of individuals and families who have shared with us that they did indeed report the abuse to both the school administration and to the Archdiocese of Baltimore. And between the years of 67 and 92, that's almost 30 years of abuse.
So all the people who have come forward to this point with their abuse stories, they're ridiculed, basically. And that quells any other victims from coming forward. That's what we learn later. And so obviously, since they're not going to get any criminal prosecution, they turn to what they can do next, and that's a civil suit.
Right. So the civil suit would mean that they would attempt to make somebody civilly liable, the church and the priests and the people who protected them. But in order to do that, they had to deal with this sort of repressed or recovered memory issue. And unfortunately, because of some celebrated cases in which repressed memories or recovered memories were actually manufactured by psychologists who were treating victims, these kinds of memories had been at the time, back then, completely discounted and discredited. Science today, though, And I think they did a really good job in this documentary of showing sort of two well-respected professionals in the field who had differing opinions about these recovered memories. And yes, you can try to lump all recovery memories together and say they're all manufactured memories, but that's not true. And there's a whole spectrum of recovered memories and recalled memories, and they should have actually taken into account the fact that these memories were not manufactured memories, but they were actually recalled memories. Today, we do know, and psychological sciences have proven the existence of the ability of the human mind to compartmentalize memory and then bring it up later. And that is what actually happened in this case. So the slick and witty guy from Johns Hopkins who made all these jokes about unicorns and bullshit like that when he spoke about these recovered memories, actually, everything he said has been completely discredited. And now today we do understand this better as a science. Now today, that kind of testimony would not have weight to it, and it wouldn't have destroyed this civil case. But unfortunately, it destroyed the case that these women bought back then.
Explain to me how it works, you guys, because I've never been in any kind of civil suit. Both sides have to go in front of a judge, and the judge determines if it's a worthy case to go forward, or that why there's all this testimony before there's actually a trial, or how does it work?
Actually, there's motions that are filed beforehand. Motions to dismiss the case are heard by the judge. There are depositions that happen beforehand, and in this case, these depositions of the victims were brutal. They made them go through every detail. They cross-examined them in ways without any protections, in ways that were demeaning and demoralizing and brutal, and made them re-victimized and talked to them about other things they were doing sexually with their boyfriends and their husbands and so forth. And it's just, it was terrible, but that's what happens in these depositions. It's a brutal, contentious process, and they were not protected during that process. In fact, I don't know if it was Jane Doe or Jane Roe who said that she brought her husband in and he was not allowed to talk to her. He was not allowed to do anything and interfere. Otherwise, they would both be thrown out. So the whole point is that this was a terrible process, but it is normal in a civil process. The thing is that normally that's about sort of business things, and it's not as common to have sexual victimization of children as the topic of a civil suit. And so the rules are really set up to protect businesses and so forth, and they're not set up to protect children here.
And Laura, haven't you sat with victims when they're being deposed like this?
I mean, yeah, I do go to court, you know, on different cases, and we'll be sat there to make representation, you know, at different times. But yeah, it's a, you know, any court process is a frightening process. And you've got to remember that you're asking someone to go in and tell their biggest secret. And, you know, any professional going to court, whether it's civil or criminal, will say, and I was training police officers last week in Hampshire, and I asked them who enjoys going to court. No hands were up. Mm. No professional really enjoys going,
it's
particularly
stressful.
If you're going to be. Yeah, it's going to be stressful. You know you're going to be cross-examined. You know someone's going to try and discredit you. You know someone's going to say that you're a liar or that you made things up. And, you know, it's a frightening process, full stop. And we forget about that. And it re-traumatizes someone. And that's exactly what we saw here, them being re-traumatized. You know, and I like the fact that you heard them say that, you know, Jean in particular, I was just going to say it how it was. And I wasn't going to be ashamed. And I was going to tell them all the details. And that the shame shouldn't be with victims. It should be, as we talked about in Brave Miss World, you know, in other cases, it should be with those perpetrators. But there's really high stakes here when someone goes to court and has to go through that terrible experience, the detail, and those questions that are asked about someone's sexual history and sexual acts and all these things that just make it such a horrible, a horrific experience with no one to protect them there. And so, yeah, whichever side it is, whether it's criminal or whether it's civil, it's a very traumatic process. And of course, there are now measures you can ask for of screens. And, you know, if someone's vulnerable, we can have special measures in place. But it's still you know, a traumatic experience, reliving and going through those, you know, triggering events and someone cross-examining you about it and calling you a liar.
Yeah, and Father Maskell, does he get to be deposed and go through this?
No, that's the thing. He took off. They took him out of his church. They hid him. He was inaccessible. Nobody got an opportunity to depose him. He was able to hide all his records, take all of them out of the church. I mean, this is just reprehensible behavior. Why did the church not mandate that he cooperate? Why did the church not force him or collect his records and then give them to the prosecutor earlier and give them to the plaintiffs in this trial? Of course, they didn't give a damn about that. They didn't give a damn about helping the victims. They gave a damn about protecting their image.
But why couldn't law enforcement go get him? I think that they think that he went to Ireland. I mean, can someone just leave the country when there's a case like this pending on them? Or why can't law enforcement go get him?
Well, this is just a civil case, so law enforcement isn't involved. They could get a subpoena to get him. They could try to extradite him, but I don't know. Maybe that Ireland doesn't extradite to the U.S. I'm not sure. Hmm. But it's very unusual on a civil case to get law enforcement involved and so forth. It's just, it's outrageous. Obviously, his attorneys were in contact with him. Obviously, they knew where he was and could get access to him. And it's obvious that he has disdain for the justice system and the legal system in the U.S. And he's, you know, flaunted his power over it. Just outrageous.
And it's clear here, you know, who's on trial. Who is actually on trial here? This is where the victims experience. It's the victims who feel that they are on trial. You know, even in a civil case, they're the ones being cross-examined. They're the ones being made to feel that they've done something wrong. You know, as we said, he's just gone off to Ireland. He's not the one that's on trial. He's just got people circling the wagons and, you know, those people who are protecting, you know, their own backs. And for the Archbishop and others, you know, life just goes on. But for the victims, their world falls apart again. You know, they've mustered up the courage, the bravery, the everything to have their day in court. And, you know, as we heard from Jean, that she felt like she lost everything. All in, you know, that occasion, her religion, her family, her sense of belonging, it literally, you know, ripped at the heart of her again. And that's why, you know, with civil cases or criminal cases, it's who's really on trial. This is where the perpetrators manage to ensure that they flip the script and we end up questioning the victim's narrative.
What was interesting was a, quote, colleague and friend of Father Maskell, who was one of his professors at Loyola, she said that Maskell was extremely bright and he collected guns for some reason and talked about that a lot. And that sounds like, again, like a cop buff, somebody who wants to be involved in the police. And clearly he got involved with the police to a great degree. And he said, he told her, he admitted to her that he had to bury psychological papers in Holy Cross Cemetery. I mean, so he admitted this. Why would any priest have to bury psychological papers? Why? I mean, that's just outrageous. And she asked Maskell how he could do these kinds of things and, you know, have tracks bags of records and high school girls exposing their breasts and psych files about all this stuff. And he said that it was moral. I mean, she then called him. She basically said he's a very manipulative guy and that this changed everything for her. This is when she finally saw him in a different light.
But you know what, Jim? See, she still doesn't really question him. I mean, she's like the tutor. You know, he's getting his psychology degree that's going to place him, you know, with vulnerable victims. And this tutor is saying, oh, he's gifted. And yeah, he had these guns and maybe he was running around playing cops and robbers or however she describes it. And then talks about the burying the papers, as you said, and thought it was odd. But the fact she has no professional curiosity around that, she doesn't ask any questions of it. I find absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. It's just sad that the people that are in a position to actually help, because they're so close to the offender, and this is like an effect of grooming. She was groomed, and she did not believe that he could be doing some of these horrible things. But when he finally admitted to it and said he thought it was moral, that's when she lost it. But The whole reason why these women could actually file a civil suit against Maskell and the church was the fact that they had recent memories, and that would restart the statute of limitations under the statutes in Maryland. And but the fact that it was repressed or recovered memory became an issue. And Paul McHugh testified for the church that these recovered memories were actually created memories, manufactured memories, and that's just bullshit. But the court bought it and threw out the case. And then in a disgusting twisting of the knife in the backs of the victims, the lawyer comes on TV and says, the victims were very confused and very disturbed. Well, that's bullshit. And he knew that, and he knew there were 30 to 100 other women that would corroborate everything that they said. And he knew that they were protecting a priest who was actually a criminal, who very likely was involved in the murder of a nun, but was absolutely 100% responsible for sexually victimizing, raping multiple times, multiple girls. And this is the person they're protecting. It's just disgusting to me. Disgusting.
It was very brutal. They asked about the actual sexual acts. I mean, after a while, I got to the point where I don't give a damn. You ask me anything you want because this happened and now the world's hearing it, and that's a good thing.
And so what does this do to Jane Doe and Jane Roe? Of course, they fall into obscurity. They just run away from this as fast as they can. And yeah, how can you blame them?
But Jane Roe, realizing that she was not worthless, realizing that she was still smart, realizing that she should have become a lawyer, she went back to law school. Even while she was raising her kids, her name is Teresa Lancaster, she went to law school and she became a lawyer. And now she takes on cases where she feels that the police are not actually doing their jobs, where people are getting railroaded, when people aren't getting justice. And now she's a hero in the law. And that's an amazing result. This is somebody who stood up for her rights, was denied her rights, yet still moved forward, still went on with her life, and still made something out of her career. And now she's helping other people. And that's a wonderful thing. And I think many people who are victimized take that opportunity to actually use it to help other people because they know they've suffered badly and they don't want others to suffer the same way.
And she's a true shero, I mean, and a true advocate. And, you know, she uses that adversity and turns it into being the mouthpiece for others who are vulnerable and who are being exploited. And I also love the fact that, you know, her husband, who she stayed with all these years, supports her and empowers her. And you just hear about how tough it was raising four children. But she would, you know, have her study in the basement and she'd sleep down there as well, you know, as a young mum, because she was so determined that she was going to get this degree. And, you know, I've got full admiration for her. It's an amazing thing and very empowering. And I've got to say, I've met, you know, some incredible people across my career who have been abused. You know, we've all had journeys, some of the toughest journeys that have turned us into some of the most incredible advocates and people who have done incredible things with their lives. And that's the real, you know, positive empowerment and great news, that you can turn that adversity into something incredible to help others. And she does exactly that.
So after the case was dismissed in 1994, 20 years go by. And in the meantime, you have this crowdsource for justice for Sister Kathy and Joyce that's being spearheaded by the dynamic duo, Gemma and Abby. But Jane Doe is not at all a part of it. Jean is not a part of that at all. And Gemma and Abby are wondering who she is and trying to find her. And that's kind of where we leave off at the end of this episode.
Right. But before that, though, they do talk about Jane Doe saying that her greatest fear was not Maskell, that Brother Bob was the one who she remembers as being the most violent with her and the most dangerous. And actually, she looked at Father Maskell as a protector from him because he would keep him in line. But she said that she remembers him saying that he is the one who actually killed Sister Kathy. And he said, it should have been you, to silence her, to silence Jane Doe, or Jean. He said it should have been you that was killed. And then he raped her. And then Maskell came back in and asked Brother Bob, did you take care of it? Is she going to stay quiet? And he said, yes, she's not going to say anything. So they used not only the threat of the murder of Sister Kathy, but then the violent rape of this girl afterwards to try to control her. And it's a very effective tool. And it's why she put these memories in the back of her mind. It's why she was dismissed later on. And unfortunately, though, it's probably also why she survived, because that's how you do it. It's a survival mechanism that kicks in with victims, that helps them get through the next day and the next week and the next year. And usually when they feel in a comfortable place, when they are grown up, when they do have their wits about them, when they're no longer at risk, then these memories come back.
She's very frustrated because she can't remember his face. And that must be so incredibly maddening. Like we've talked about before, you remember bits and pieces. And the episode has a cliffhanger. Who is Brother Bob?
And Brother Bob was, of course, the more sadistic one. And I think this is the real twist in the tale of what abusers do, and those who are very manipulative, is that she starts to see Maskell as her protector. And this is the real juxtaposition, isn't it, Jim? That he has flipped the script so that, you know, Brother Bob is the scarier one and more sadistic, but somehow Maskell takes up this position of being her protector, in inverted commas, that he's the one reigning, you know, Brother Bob in. And so you've got this really twisted dynamic that's now being created, that's even more confusing.
Right. So it's a lot like Stockholm Syndrome and good cop, bad cop kind of thing. And it's clearly something that he used to manipulate her into silence yet again. And all the other girls who suffered at his hand, I'm sure he did exactly the same thing to them. And I think that the fact that many girls would hear the announcements over the speaker that some girl was being summoned to his offices, and they would all cringe. They would all know what was going on, at least the ones that were being victimized themselves. But it's an unfortunate thing, and little do they know that if they could actually break outside of this community, and if they could actually get to law enforcement, like the FBI at that time, if they knew that was a resource, damn, it would have blown this case right open. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. I just hope that there's a way that this is being prevented today, that all our listeners out there today, that they know that this is a reality. This happens. And it's not just priests in the Catholic Church. It's any clergy. It's anybody working in any youth-serving organization. They're all capable of doing this kind of thing, no matter what kind of nice person or intelligent person or captivating, charismatic person they are. They can still sexually victimize children. They can have a sexual attraction to children, and they can act on it. They can use their power and authority over these kids, and they can groom kids and the parents and guardians and the community to believing that they're good people, when in fact they're taking advantage of these kids sexually in the privacy of their offices or their homes or other places. And we need to be vigilant to protect these kids. And if you do suspect something, don't simply just ask a question and walk away. If somebody does make an allegation, don't let the offender just resign and walk away and go somewhere else. Make a record of it. Report it to the police. Even if you don't have enough to prove a case, make a record. Force them to take a complaint. Force them to write it down. Force them to put the details of who you're talking about and who the victims are, so that later, when there are more, there could be a critical mass that's reached, and they can do something about it in the justice system and try to amend the justice system so that one child's voice is greater than the voice of any offender, and that if they get multiple victims to come forward, that they will crush the offenders and stop it from happening, period.
And also call bullshit on those professionals who and not doing their jobs, because ultimately, you know, she was in public office and she did make that statement on public record where it's very clear that she didn't know the letter of the law. And what she says, of course, goes out to the masses. And that sets a standard that people think when they're listening to her, that the prosecutor in particular, that she knows what she's talking about. And of course, she doesn't. So for me, it's also about those people who are in public office, who are paid by the public purse, who are there to protect and defend and to prosecute and to keep people safe, protect and serve. And there are those individuals who are not doing their jobs. And we do have to call that out too, as uncomfortable as that is, because we want to make sure that people are educated. And of course, in a murder inquiry, I go back to the point, in a murder inquiry, you don't have the victim's statement. You don't have them giving an account. You build the case. And that's what we would expect, you know, to have an inquiring mind, professional curiosity, to ask the right questions.
Yes, they could have gotten subpoenas for records. They could have put bugs in his office. They could have done a million things to verify what this woman was saying. And yet they did nothing. And, you know, and I'll go back, I mean, to Sister Kathy. She was most likely forced out of that school because she confronted him. And clearly, Maskell went back and tortured the victim for speaking about it, and may very well have either killed Sister Kathy or had somebody else kill Sister Kathy. But he certainly used her death to keep the victims quiet, in particular Jane.
Exactly. So I just want to, you know, do a shout out to leadership for those professionals, because actually what she didn't show was leadership. And, you know, whatever your role is, whether you're in law enforcement, whether you're in the DA's office, whether you're a Crown prosecutor, you know, in the CPS here, you have to show leadership in this area. And I just want to thank you, Jim, for showing, you know, for speaking out and showing leadership as a former, you know, prosecutor, but also, you know, as an FBI agent and someone who has tried these cases, who's brought them, who's spent a lot of time building these cases and being the voice for the voiceless. So I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Laura. And I want people to know out there in all those professions, law enforcement, child welfare, child advocates, any kind of prosecutor or judge or anybody in a position who feels like they don't know what they can do in this, they can reach out to the Behavioral Analysis Unit and the FBI. There are many resources out there. There are organizations like Stop It Now. There are organizations like Safe for Athletes that have model policies and have rules and regulations that people that work in youth organizations should follow. And these kinds of things, don't be ashamed. Don't be afraid to reach out and ask for help if you don't know how to put these cases together. The Behavioral Analysis Unit keeps records of successful prosecutions in these areas, and just like they do with no-body homicide prosecutions. And because of that, if you can convict a person of murder without ever having found the body, you certainly can convict a child sex crimes case when you have the victim who's actually able to testify. Yeah, some of these disgusting offenders offend against children who were pre-verbal, offend against children who are not even old enough to testify. And of course, those are much more difficult cases to prove by the victim's statements. But you can always use other measures. You can use electronic surveillance. You can use video surveillance. You can get warrants and searches and check out computer material and writing material and talk to other people around them. And you can build cases, you can find people. If they're molesting one kid, they're most likely molesting others. Build a case, do your job, reach out for help if you don't know how to do it. There are people around who can help you. Laura and I will certainly be happy to do it. And there are literally hundreds of other experts in the field who could also help you out there, and we'll put you in touch with them.
Thank you. And thank you to Lisa to speaking out as well. I appreciate you sharing your experience, and you know, that reaches out into the hearts of many people. So, you know, thank you so much. I think this has been a really powerful, not just episode, but our coverage. So we know there are people out there.
I mean, you make it a very safe space for me to be able to talk about all kinds of things. And that's so special. And thank you very much.
Until next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.